Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have Shireen Gorbani on the left.
Hello, and hey, listeners. So glad you're with us.
Happy Thanksgiving season, holiday season, all of the rest. And Shireen, we have in the studio with us today, on the right, Senator Dan McKay.
Who?
Our visiting professor. Pleasure to be with you all again today.
Glad to have you, Dan. So much going on. Let's run through these. I'm going to start with the international issue. The new Mexican president, Claudia Sheinbaum. I don't know how to say it in Spanish.
Sheinbaum? Yeah.
She's blasted Donald Trump because of his tariff proposal, a 25% proposal on imports from Canada and Mexico. She's threatening retaliatory tariffs. That's no surprise. She actually read publicly from her letter to Trump about the economic consequences of a trade war, job losses, higher prices. Wow. She sounds like a strong leader, Shireen.
She does. So I guess as our economist, can you just help people understand a little bit more about tariffs and what this could actually mean for Americans?
Yeah. I mean, in economics, everyone knows this that's worked with economists. It's hard to get agreement. They always say if you line economists end to end, you get a circle, you know, kind of thing. Or there's the whole thing about Harry Truman said, I need a one-handed economist, because they'd say on the one hand and then on the other hand. Yeah, that kind of stuff. But one thing that economists typically really line up behind and agree on is that international trade, free trade, no tariffs is a good thing.
And a good thing why? For whom?
Well, the first thing that happens is nobody takes a tariff line down. So you put on a tariff and you start a trade war. So you instantly add distortions to the market. Mm-hmm. In our country, if you put on tariffs, a lot of those are inputs that then manufacturers take and then they pass on to
consumers.
So it functions a lot like a tax. It's not in all goods. A lot of it depends on the forces of supply and demand. But the bottom line is international trade has been one of the biggest things that's lifted people out of poverty, improved standards of living, and created wealth globally in this world. And when we start shutting down borders, we lose all of these comparative advantages of trade. Yeah. Now, Dan, you're a businessman. Did I do that okay? Was that too long?
Nope. I thought that was great. It's a good, if anybody really wants an in-depth discovery or understanding of tariffs and risks that come associated with them, tune into Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Mm-hmm. Can't wait to hear this.
There is a famous scene in there where, you know, anyone, Bueller.
Bueller?
He's
Bueller?
Like the Holly Smoot Tariff Act.
Oh, my goodness.
Which raised or lowered, which, you know,
happening in the movie, huh?
The whole clip is hilarious.
Yeah.
And he goes into, and he actually is talking about the Great Depression and how, you know, Roosevelt used tariffs at that point to try and reinforce the American workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, felt like it lengthened the time of the Great Depression.
Yeah, it's a classic textbook example of, you know, one of the causes of the Great Depression. And just remind our listeners, Senator Smoot was a Utah senator.
Yeah, I was going to say, it has a Utah connection. But the tariffs themselves, again, I love the Mexican president because I love, you know, a strong executive sounds great, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, sounds entertaining. America has elected a strong executive for
this next
term.
Yep.
And, you know, for all intents and purposes, he's going to be accountable for the policies that he has. And, you know, I don't think that the tariffs are going to be the end all. I think the threat of the tariff is much more his weapon than the actual tariff is. And that's, I think, you know, if we learn nothing from 2016 to 2020 Trump, he is all about, you know, making threats about things that he's willing to do, but not actually carry them out.
Many Americans voted for a president that they hope won't do what he says.
Yeah, I think that's right. I also think a lot of
it's crazy,
voted for,
but, you know,
and we know, like, there was this incredible graphic of things that were Googled after Trump won, and tariffs was one of the most Googled terms.
Interesting.
So people really didn't understand. I mean, and I understand why. Mm-hmm. This is a complex system. But the thing that I think is interesting about this is it's a conflation of two issues, right? So we have the tariffs being leveled as part of a threat around immigration. So it is bringing together two things that need separate interventions, two things that need separate solutions and thinking. But trying to blend them together, I think, is actually creating a real potential for disaster here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
We have got to talk about immigration, right?
Yeah. Well, let's go there.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Because, you know, this is an issue that's getting a ton of attention. We've got Governor Cox, who's now essentially said, hey, I'm going to go along with President Trump on deporting undocumented immigrants who commit crimes. Who can blame him?
Yep.
You know, he wants to be about public safety. But, Dan, yep. You have a special interest in this.
Well, you know, I have this rhetoric, and it is, even causes, you know, questions in our home. Like, mm-hmm. we're trying to figure this out as well, because we've housed refugees in our home and have been active in the refugee community in Utah for a number of years now. And it's an issue that's near and dear to our hearts. And the interesting thing that I think that is, you know, kind of bubbling up is you see really this economy where people feel like they don't have jobs, or jobs are eroding them, or they're not eligible for them, or whatever it might be. And as a result, you've got this problem that's developing in middle America, where you've got people that are struggling to make ends meet. And I think that's really the undercurrent behind the immigration debate, is that inflation has been harder than people thought it was going to be. The economy is not as good as, you know, even, you know, right or left politicians want to talk about. It's not as good as people think it is. And I think there's a real pain in middle America that's driving this, you know, how do we keep America, America? There's also cultural conflict and some of those things. And I think all that's tied up in the fact that literally if Trump, he's got one term, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I think about the pressure that needs to be on Congress to solve both of these issues. It has to be considered together, because if they don't, and they don't deal with them together, there isn't going to be the ability for the art of possible, or like a solution that can solve the problem. My biggest problem with what the Biden administration did with immigration is they basically said, well, you're right, everybody now can qualify as a refugee. I mean, pretty much you fill out an app on a phone. No, this is we have some firsthand experience. So
yeah,
I'll just share this. And I'll just say there are some exceptions, but for the most part, just about everybody can. And what's happening is at least the perception of that, or like the perception of it being an open border, is causing this immigration consternation. Whether or not there's a lot of immigration or there's a lot of, you know, problems, it's just causing pressure. And I'm hoping that Congress will fix this, that we will come up mm-hmm. with a guest worker program that actually works,
yeah.
because we need the labor.
Love this.
We need it. And so
yes.
My problem is, doing what the Biden administration did is the Biden administration took the pressure off. And by taking the pressure off, Congress will not act when there's no pressure.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to, there is a point of clarification there. And then the refugee, like
I'm getting fact checked.
Individuals awesome. That come in on refugee status are different, I think, than what you're talking about, which is people who are now, you are correct in that the Biden administration said that people could apply for asylum, and asylum seeking is we talk about that as a refugee status, but it's actually not the refugee status.
Yes.
Yeah. So I just wanted to be clear on that, because what we're going to see is refugees, mm-hmm. Which we've been largely welcoming to in this country and in this state particularly. That number was cut down to nearly zero in the previous Trump administration. That's been built back slowly, not as quickly as many in refugee, advocacy areas would love to see. Under the Biden administration, it was actually kept quite low.
Well, but last year in Utah, it was twice what it was during the highest year ever before. So,
right.
I mean, it is catching up.
But I want to be sure that we're saying that is like refugee status refugees,
right?
So then on the other side, then we have the individuals who approach the border who are able to seek asylum status. Mm-hmm. And you have a legal right to seek asylum. And that was found under courts under Trump as well.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So I'm not saying that the system is good or bad, but that these are different categorizations of people. And I couldn't agree with you more. And I think one of the most interesting parts of this is now we're seeing, with the threats of mass deportation, first of all, I guess before I say interesting, I want to say heartbreaking. I've been on the street when ICE has shown up and taken people out of a house next door to where I was living.
Yeah.
So I understand this.
Mm-hmm.
And there is also a very clear need around certain kinds of jobs. When I lived in Nebraska, there were regular raids at the meatpacking plants where some of the only folks who worked there were undocumented folks.
And that existence is sucky.
The jobs are terrible.
The jobs, but I will tell you from growing up, when I grew up in San Diego, close to the border, right? The existence of people who are undocumented, they're like, you know, the parents of my friends, they were concerned
about. You can't report crimes against you.
Yes,
you can't
like their whole
speed.
List.
Yeah. anything. And your life becomes so much more difficult.
Fixing all that stuff. Yeah. The last time we tried to fix it under the Reagan administration, it was, you know, they got like halfway to the solution, but they didn't finish it off. And that was unfortunate because Congress took the easy way out.
This is going to be interesting to watch. We looked at the data here and, you know, basically ICE has deported two people from Utah a month since January 2021.
So,
not a lot.
So, yeah.
But as high as 22 in 2018. But those numbers are going to go up a lot, Shireen.
Those numbers will go up a lot. And I just have to say, I find this to be sort of the most disingenuous kind of political theater from our governor that I find very upsetting. At any moment now, currently, you could step up your enforcement and deport individuals who are committing crimes. That is something he could have been doing the last 4 years. The fact that he decided to put out this Instagram post, this press release, on the week of, like, as we head into the holidays, just feels so unchristian to me. Like, I just find it to be so frustrating when we think about the fact that there are individuals who are experiencing real harm from crimes that are committed. Very small portion of individuals who are here undocumented that are committing crimes. But those individuals could already be deported.
And let's do lightning round for just a second on a couple of things. Jack Smith has dropped the federal charges against Trump.
Can I just say that? I just love it. I love having this conversation because there is a lot of middle ground. We recognize the economic success of this country.
There's some policy interventions that will work.
There was a very conservative bill that got killed by Donald Trump just months ago.
Let's just figure out a way.
But now you've got Republican domination. They can get something done in the first year.
Yeah.
Do it. Yeah. Okay, let's take a break, and then we'll come back, and I'll do this lightning round. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gurbani and Dan McKay. Stay tuned, everyone.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gurbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and we are doing a lightning round of all this news. So, Dan, I'll start with you. Jack Smith has dropped the federal charges against Trump on the stolen documents and the attempted coup. No surprise here, right? He had to do this.
No, it should have been done a long time ago. But
And Shireen, what they're crying foul over is that the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, allowed more than a year to pass before embarking on this probe.
Yeah.
Could have changed the course of history.
Also, I feel like this is the real win for Donald Trump. Basically getting presidential immunity allows him to not have to be held accountable for many things.
So also, Shireen, the hush money conviction in New York, Judge Merchan has indefinitely postponed the sentencing.
Same win.
But notice, you know, they're dismissing without prejudice. I mean, that's in our, you know, in other words, they're reserving the right to still come after Donald Trump, you know, post-election or post-off 2028. It's like, seriously, folks, like, what are we doing? Like, I don't know. I think most of America said those, they felt political in nature. The venues felt political. The issues felt very nuanced and felt political. Let this stuff go.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, we've got all these Trump cabinet picks, and we don't have to go through them one by one, but I wanted to share an observation somebody made to me yesterday and just get your reaction to it. You know, public policy is part policy, part communications. They intersect. Mm-hmm. And this person made the observation that many of the president-elect's picks are great communicators. And that's going to be a real something we haven't thought about. So we think of them as inexperienced, bad fits. You can think of a whole bunch of adjectives to describe them, Shireen.
Yeah.
But many of them, including RFK Jr., including the Fox people, whatever, they're storytellers. They're communicators. Mm-hmm. And that they can communicate a message that his first term, the cabinet members couldn't do.
Perhaps I would say one. I think
Shireen's
one of the biggest,
persuaded. Dan.
Well, I guess what I would say is one of the biggest challenges with Trump is that it's hard to imagine anyone getting any airtime when Donald Trump is in the room, right?
Yeah.
So they may be highly talented, but he is a force for taking up space and time. And actually, that's been the thing I've been trying to avoid. I just don't want to. I don't like to delineate that much of my time to somebody who, is so destructive.
Yeah.
But I think that there is, it's going to be hard for them to find their message when he is speaking.
Yeah. Dan, your reaction to the picks, we've already, because they've been going on, they've been kind of filtering out for a few days now, and Shereen and I have already commented on them. You know, for the most part, I'm sort of horrified by it, because I want the most competent people in our country to be over these things. I mean, I worked at Health and Human Services, and the thought of someone who doesn't believe in public health or doesn't, you know, support vaccines is really troubling to me. My father was a physician. My older sister was one of the first children in Utah to get a polio vaccine. I've seen the picture of her, you know, with the star or whatever that showed that she got it. I mean, this is an ethos that means something to me. Science means something to me. Modern medicine does. And just I'm troubled.
Sure.
But what's your reaction?
Let me just return it with a question.
Yeah.
Okay. What was the first cabinet appointment that that Mike Leavitt got that you ended up working?
EPA.
EPA, right?
Yeah, right.
So let's just evaluate for a moment Mike Leavitt's abilities to manage the EPA from his resume. Would you say that his resume leaned into EPA?
Listen, a couple of things on there, but I when we went to Health and Human Services, I remember having a conversation with him saying, does it trouble you that you're not a doctor?
Yeah.
Because I was sort of thinking, but absolutely not. So let me give, it doesn't trouble me. So, so as governor, he dealt with environmental issues all the time.
Sure.
And he was the co-founder of the In Libra Doctrine, which looked for balance in, in environmental discussions. He had been a CEO of a company, so he knew how to lead, and he'd been a governor three times elected.
Yeah,
I think that's a great background. When he went to HHS, because he specialized in insurance, Medicare, Medicaid.
Right. I just, the only reason I say that is it is, I feel like we think that the person needs to be qualified to like lead the administration, which, and you know this better than I do, in the Department of Health, there are, you know, 50 department heads or, you know, maybe more or less.
Assistant secretaries,
right? Who are actually hands-on experts on those issues, and it becomes their job to advise. And what you're really looking for is somebody who can receive that information and make good decisions based on trusting people, trusting decisions, that kind of thing. And I think that balancing the political, balancing the ability to tell the story, so to speak, in the narrative, and take advice, it's too early to know whether or not these people are experts. Because I look at, you know, the early part of COVID, Donald Trump followed Dr. Fauci and their recommendations to, you know, try and slow things down. Like, he doesn't get enough credit for doing some of those things because of the things he was saying at the time were very distracting to the cause, right?
Like, if I wear a mask, I look weak.
I know. But all of those things being said, you know, it's too early. I think cabinet positions are always political people, and you have to see how they end up holding
it. I come from a different orientation, though, because I come from the orientation of like a Tommy Thompson, who was the first Homeland Security Secretary. Remind me of his name, the governor of Pennsylvania. Tom Ridge.
Yeah, there you go.
But in any case, I'm accustomed to fabulous talents, experienced people being in most of the cabinet posts.
Yeah. I think that's a key.
Todd Whitman, you know, I'm a Republican, and these are my Republican stars and whatnot. But
I've noticed that and you take this however you will. I've noticed that the best leaders, the ones who are, you know, who do the job, lean into the job the most, they're the ones who surround themselves with the absolute best and brightest, smartest people to do stuff. And they're able to, you know, execute within that realm, and they're not threatened by having smarter people around them.
I have another comment to make, but I want to bring you in, Shereen. Tell us a couple thoughts you have here.
As you're going through this, I'm thinking of, you know, some of the standouts in the Biden administration. It would be difficult, I think, for Democrats not to say that they have been impressed by Mayor Pete, right? Mm-hmm. So Pete Buttigieg gets put in charge of what?
Transportation.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Is that his expertise?
No. Mm-hmm.
Certainly not. But he is an excellent communicator, and he is an excellent executive.
Yeah.
And did a really good job going out and communicating to the public the broader message about what was happening, whether it was now if you get kicked off a flight, you know, there like the changes that have been made. from an administrative level that airlines now need to refund you, and they need to refund you quickly. Like, these are, you know, important changes that have been made. The reason I know that is because Mayor Pete's a good communicator, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think there's space for all of it, I don't think there's space for all of it. What I'm concerned about is when we have people that are deeply, like the person who wants to run for student council to disband student council, those are the people who I'm not interested in being in charge. And I'm afraid we have a little bit too much of that in the Trump administration.
A friend of mine shared this Turkish proverb with me that says, if the clown enters the palace, it doesn't make him king. The palace becomes a circus. The circus begins.
I don't love that. I know you guys don't like Trump. I'm just saying.
Well, to me, it's sort of
the
like
American people have spoken.
We're going to see if this is a circus or not.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, if Matt Gaetz would have been confirmed.
There's always a circus element to the presidency. Yeah.
And Matt Gaetz already was a circus, just to be clear.
Fair. I'm not 100% convinced. I think he had to. He was looking for an exit from Congress, mm-hmm. and I look at that pick as Trump was trying to give a strong supporter who is an attorney, who, you know, felt like he could have done the job, a way out of Congress without having to deal with the other parts of it. But I don't, I would not have chosen Matt Gaetz, but, you know, that's me.
Shereen, I'm always really interested in the Treasury pick, really important to the economy. Scott Bessent has received that pick. I think it's a great pick. I think he'll be good. But someone pointed out to me that multiple picks of Trump are Democrats.
And billionaires.
Okay, yeah, that's true. But it's so funny to me because I was thinking, I wonder if he'll put any Democrats in his cabinet. And now he's doing it. And then I read an article where they said, well, he used to be a Democrat, so none of this should surprise us.
No. And I do
Scott
think
Bessent used to be a Democrat. I mean, it just...
One of the hardest parts about sort of navigating this moment of Trump, and I know we're going to find some time to talk about the presidential election more broadly, but when we think about the disruption that Trump has brought, you have numerous times, and so have you, Dan, over the years, been concerned about what Donald Trump's kind of core value set means mm-hmm. to the Republican Party mm-hmm. or what it means to Republicanism more broadly. And I think the kind of flipping of the electorate when we think about working class or some of the conversations that are happening in the analyses of what actually happened, a sort of populist authoritarian is not necessarily in line with Republican values, right? So how does this all kind of come together? How does it play out? I think it is breaking our politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. All right, let's go local. Dan, want to capture your expertise here. What is going on with Rocky Mountain Power and the legislature? You got an investor-owned utility, and just for our listeners, this is a Berkshire Hathaway company, a Warren Buffett company, and it's providing electricity to most of our state. We also have municipal. I'm a Murray resident. We have our own power company. I'm not a customer of Rocky Mountain Power. We have mm-hmm. rural co-ops. But we're a big investor-owned utility state, and mm-hmm. the legislature seems to be at war with Rocky Mountain Power. They're actually asking this Dick Garlish, who's the president of Rocky Mountain Power, to tell the legislature what it would be like if he split off from PacifiCorp.
Well, I think that's been... That's been great, that other side of the conversation. What I think this highlights, though, is you've got states that before we were isolated from, right? We were insulated with our power production and everything else. We were insulated, really, from California rates, from Washington rates, mm-hmm. from Oregon rates. And those rates are much higher than mm-hmm. our rates mm-hmm. are. And then you've got Berkshire Hathaway, who saw the opportunity after, you know, PacifiCorp and San Diego Gas and Electric and all the other things in California there, you know, after the big wildfire that happened through, and then the bankruptcy, the acquisition, and then the consolidation of ownership between all of those entities mm-hmm. now exposes us in the environment to those rates.
Yeah. So higher rates because of environmental policies, Shereen, in the Northwest that affect Utah rates. That's what's the bug under the pillow of
well,
the legislature.
And we subsidize coal and the declining kind of appetite for keeping alive infrastructure that is.
When you say subsidize coal, what are you referring to?
So I guess what I mean is we have long.
Public finance people here, Dan and I, are like, what is she talking about?
Yes. So there are many forces in, I would say, the greater kind of economy around energy that are making coal much more expensive over time.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
That's fair enough. And we don't have a coal severance tax in this state, and we do for oil and gas. So it's always been an interesting thing that coal doesn't get a severance tax.
Right.
So that might be an example. But
we are keeping alive coal plants or coal infrastructure that is way beyond its life cycle. And the question is, do we want to reinvest in that?
Dan, 1 minute. Give us the 40-second preview of the 2025 session.
Well, it is going to be a circus. to borrow from your language from before, but it always is, and it will be no different than it was in the past.
Judiciary, elections, higher ed.
Power.
And power. Electricity.
Electricity stuff. And, you know, and then there's always a few, like, Hail Mary social issues that get worked in there as well.
Yeah. Transgender.
I don't think so. Okay. I'm just saying, I don't know. I feel like we've done everything that needs to or should be done.
It would be difficult to make it more hostile for trans folks in this
exactly.
state.
Yeah. Shireen, all that system is buckle up.
Yep.
We're going to have listeners stay tight. We're going to be talking about changes in the judiciary, threats to higher ed, changes in our election system, and certainly power and electricity will loom large. All right. That's a wrap for our program. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gorbani and Dan McKay. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everyone, for listening.